Now, though, on Radio 4, the science writer Philip Ball investigates the relationship between scientific advice and policy and what it might mean to be led by the science.
Our response is built upon the bedrock of the best possible scientific and medical advice so that we can take the right steps at the right time.
At each point throughout our response to coronavirus,
at each point,
we've been following the scientific
best possible scientific.
We have been following the scientific.
Been following scientific
and medical advice.
And medical advice.
And medical advice.
And medical advice.
And we've been very deliberate in our actions.
We have been deliberate in our actions.
And we've been deliberate in our actions.
Taking the right steps at the right time.
Taking the right steps at the right moment.
So that we can take the right steps at the right time.
Taking the right steps at the right time.
The simulations didn't work, we weren't well prepared, and we did nothing about it. I can't understand why we did nothing about it. We were utterly unprepared, even for an influenza outbreak.
I mean, I think there's an inherent tension in talking about the science, because clearly there wasn't a single scientific consensus at the time, and that's problematic. That's always going to be a challenge when you're dealing with a situation of uncertainty.
It's not just laying out what the scientists understand about a particular opportunity or a particular challenge, but it is saying, and this is the policy advice that the chief scientific advisor distills down from talking to the scientists.
We want scientists, obviously, to contribute to public service and play these kind of roles, but, you know, who would sign up to be a chief scientist after this? I don't know.
The COVID-19 pandemic caused by the coronavirus is nothing less than a global catastrophe, the most disruptive outbreak of infectious disease since the Spanish flu of 1918-19. Around 700,000 people have died from the disease. Economies have been shattered, huge numbers of jobs lost. From the outset, the British government insisted it would be led by the science, informed by what we know about the virus and the disease it caused, by epidemiological models of how it spread, and medical and behavioural advice about how to prevent this. The UK has some of the world's most distinguished experts in infectious disease, and a national health service that is widely admired and respected. We seemed, then, to be in hands as safe as could be hoped. 6 months into the pandemic, the UK had the second highest per capita death rate in the world, and England had suffered the highest number of excess deaths for this period in all of Europe. In the ways that arguably matter most, the response has been disastrous. Who got it wrong? The scientists or the government? That sort of blame game is too simplistic. We need to look at what it can possibly mean for government policy to be led by the science. I'm going to dig into the machinery of science and governance in the UK. I'll speak to experts who know how these gears really turn and who have themselves been part of the mechanism. If we're to avoid another national catastrophe like this one, perhaps even before this year is out, we need to ask if the framework for feeding science into policy is fit for purpose. The importance of good scientific advice became clear after the Second World War, during which Winston Churchill had relied heavily on his scientific advisor, Frederick Lindemann. James Wilsdon, Professor of Research Policy at the University of Sheffield, explains how this post later became formalised.
Wilson's government in 64 created the post, and the first holder of the role was Solly Zuckerman, who was, I think, initially asked to come into government and resisted that and instead struck an arrangement with Wilson whereby he would occupy this role very much at the heart of government, but still retaining some of the independence that we associate with the role of the government chief scientist. So he held the role, and I think even continued to have an office in the Cabinet Office for some years after he actually stepped down. So he was a very influential figure in that government and, in a sense, set the mould for the role over succeeding decades.
In 1961, Zuckerman explained what he felt the responsibilities and boundaries of scientific advice to government are.
Advisory bodies can only advise. In our system of government, the power of decision must rest with the minister concerned or with the government as a whole. If scientists want more than this, then they'd better become politicians.
The need for reliable, independent scientific advice has only become more urgent since then. To deal with issues such as acid rain, climate change, nuclear power, and infectious disease. The relationship of science and governance had one of its most stringent tests in the early 1990s with the outbreak of BSE, or mad cow disease, in which there was a possible risk of the condition being passed to people through beef.
The Agriculture Minister, John Gummer, today enrolled his daughter, Cordelia, in his campaign to persuade people that eating beef is safe.
When you've got the clear support of the scientists who deal with these matters, the clear support of the Department of Health, the clear action of the government, there's no need to be worried.
But John Gummer's comment turned out to be dangerously premature, and the BSE outbreak led to a public inquiry. One of its conclusions was that science advice to government needs to be independent and transparent. That lesson wasn't lost on the chief scientific advisor to Tony Blair's government, chemist Sir David King, when in 2001 another epidemic struck British livestock, foot and mouth disease, spread by a virus.
When the Prime Minister gave the job to me to take it over, I promised that within 3 days we would turn exponential growth of the disease spreading across British farms into exponential decay within 3 days. Now, we managed to achieve it, but this is critically important because in this exponential growth phase, every day that you lose, the epidemic is getting away from you. So it becomes critically important to act very, very quickly. Every single day, I was talking to the media. I was on television virtually every day reporting the state of the epidemic, what we were doing, why we were culling animals, in what way it was deemed, which animals should be culled. The science advisory groups that I set up, they weren't called SAGE. That was John Beddington, my successor, who invented that wonderful acronym. I wish I'd thought of it. But as with SAGE, each group that I set up to deal with a particular situation was composed of experts relevant to the problem. Quite simply, I reported to COBRA every weekday morning and on other mornings. We often had a cup of coffee with the Prime Minister in his pyjamas.
While disease outbreaks like BSE and foot and mouth posed serious concerns for human health or the economy, what has kept many scientists awake at night over the past decades is the threat of an epidemic caused by a lethal virus that infects humans directly. Many feared this would take the form of a particularly virulent strain of flu. But there are other infectious killers out there. In 2003, a disease called Severe Acute Respiratory Syndrome, or SARS, was reported in China, caused by a different type of virus, called a coronavirus. SARS didn't go global, but the threat was clear. Most scientists working on infectious disease have long said that something like the COVID-19 pandemic was inevitable. Mindful of that, in 2016, NHS England carried out a simulation study called Exercise Cygnus that looked at the effects of a lethal flu epidemic in the UK. The conclusion was deeply alarming. We were nowhere near prepared to prevent large-scale fatalities. Yet other, seemingly more pressing issues were about to dominate the British political agenda until, at the start of January this year, reports began to emerge from China of a new disease that looked a lot like SARS.
Officials say the 61-year-old man shopped regularly at this seafood market and that it was the source of the virus. It's been sealed off by police and disinfected. The outbreak began in December,
where the mystery virus was first identified, an outbreak that's since turned deadly. Scores of infections have been confirmed, but now
it's official. China's mysterious new virus can pass from person to person. Health authorities there are urging the public not to...
It's 10 o'clock. Good evening. This is The World Tonight. Is the outbreak of a new respiratory virus in China an international public health emergency? The World Health Organization will meet to decide.
There is a risk of a spread of the infectious disease internationally, and that coordinated international response is needed.
The risk was soon clear. as Richard Horton, editor of the leading medical journal, The Lancet, explains.
By the end of January, we knew that we had a brand new virus on our hands. It was a virus that was transmitted from human to human. It was a virus with no treatment and no vaccine that was tipping hundreds, if not thousands, of people into hospitals across China. Many of those people were ending up on intensive care, and a high proportion of those people were dying. At the same time, again before the end of January, it was very clear that we had the potential for a global pandemic on our hands. There was a very clear plan of action that should have been followed that was elaborated in the five papers we published at the end of January and further detailed by the World Health Organization. One had to rely on building up a test, trace, and isolate system within public health so that community transmission could be prevented, because as soon as you get community transmission, virtually the only option then, if you're trying to cut the lines of viral transmission, is a lockdown. And so our priority in the early part of February should have been to try and prevent the possibility of a lockdown by preventing the virus entering our communities.
So should we simply have followed that plan? That wasn't a purely scientific question, but it depended crucially on the advice of scientific experts, in particular the chief scientific advisor, Sir Patrick Vallance, a former head of R&D at the pharmaceuticals giant GlaxoSmithKline, with years of experience in public health, and the chief medical officer, Sir Chris Whitty, himself a specialist in the spread of infectious disease, who had worked on the Ebola outbreak in Sierra Leone. They in turn relied on an expert committee called the Scientific Advisory Group for Emergencies, or SAGE. James Wilsdon.
I think the strengths of SAGE, which we have seen in part through this process, are its responsiveness, its fluidity, the fact you can mobilise and assemble very quickly relevant experts to tackle a given emergency, and then they break up and sort of go back and carry on with their day jobs. I think the weakness in this particular crisis has also been that fluidity, in that you've had this structure which has been forced in a very odd way, really, to the forefront of political and policy debate.
This mechanism for feeding science advice into policy was about to be stress-tested as never before.
The chief scientific advisor is normally a backroom figure, but the SAGE committee certainly is a backroom entity. So for it to be thrust forward in the way it has been, given its fluidity, given that there are no fixed members, it's not a committee that has a fixed identity. You know, what is SAGE? That's not to say the SAGE structure is sort of inherently flawed. I don't think it is. I just think it was never set up to deal with this degree of public media intense scrutiny.
From the outset, the government said it would be taking the best advice it could get from these top scientists. That intention was made plain in the daily press briefings, in which the Prime Minister or other government members appeared side by side with their chief scientific advisers. Social psychologist Julia Pearce of King's College London advises the Cabinet Office on planning for health emergencies. She says this was a good strategy for establishing public trust.
When you're communicating with a view to encouraging behavioural change in response to an unfamiliar threat such as COVID-19, one of the key elements that is going to feed in and what is considered the primary route to cooperation from a risk perception communication perspective is trust in the people who are communicating the message. And so obviously, ideally, what you have done is you've built that trust ahead of time, but you certainly want to communicate in a way that maintains it and hopefully further builds it.
Not everyone saw it this way, though. James Wilsdon.
I mean, the very first moment I saw the first of those press conferences with the chief scientist and the chief medical officer flanking the Prime Minister, you know, while in one sense it's great to see scientists sort of having a prominent role, it also rang all sorts of alarm bells in terms of what was going on with respect to lines of accountability and the blurring of the distinction between advice and decision making. I can understand why at the outset of the pandemic there was a temptation to fall back on that kind of account, because it clearly in communications terms there's a sort of clarity and simplicity to the idea that the science is a singular thing. It's giving an answer to which the Prime Minister and ministers are then responding. Clearly that's not what was going on, and what we're gradually uncovering through more and more of the evidence and interviews that different members of SAGE and Chris Whitty, Patrick Vallance and others are giving, the situation is much more complicated, as of course it would have been. I mean, no, you know, how could it not have been? So I think that it was problematic to allow that kind of language to emerge early on.
This perception goes to the heart of the matter. Science is widely trusted because we learn that its methods produce reliable facts from data, and that's often the case. But in a situation like this one, science has no magic formula for conjuring certainties out of big unknowns, especially when it needs to act so swiftly. Neither can it by itself determine or reveal the best policy decisions. Sir Paul Nurse, a Nobel laureate biologist and head of the Crick Institute for Biomedical Research in London, explains that it's a common mistake to attribute this degree of certainty to science.
The problem, I think, is underpinning some of this, is that we are taught science at school like it's been chiseled in granite, like Newton's laws of physics. But science, which we do today in the case of a pandemic, isn't chiseled in stone. It is, in fact, tentative, and it will change as knowledge accumulates and ideas are tested. That's where I think part of the problem lies. The public thinks science is absolutely certain, and then politicians are saying we're following the science because it has that certainty. And then we scientists get it wrong, as we will, and because that's just what's going to happen, because it's tentative knowledge getting clearer and clearer.
James Wilsdon argues that the way science was being presented by the government at the start of the pandemic encouraged this misconception.
I think too often it's in both the interests of the politicians and the scientists to sort of flip back to a narrative of science or a version of science, a counter science that never existed, but certainly one that is thoroughly out of step with the way we think about science today. And it's incumbent both on the scientists themselves, when they're in advisory roles, I think, not to participate in the illusion of a version of science that isn't true. And of course, it's also incumbent on the politicians not to fall back on or perpetuate some sort of myth of the way science operates and the way it can cut through the messiness and complexity of these sorts of situations.
In late January, the World Health Organization declared COVID-19 a public health emergency of international concern and explained what countries needed to do to prepare. Some listened and some didn't. Jeremy Farrar is director of the Wellcome Trust and an expert on infectious disease who sits on SAGE.
I first knew about this emergence in, I think, the 31st of December or the 1st of January, when an old colleague, the head of China CDC, Center for Disease Control, phoned me up and let me know something unusual was happening. The WHO was warning people from the first week of January that this was a very serious infection and countries needed to prepare and not wait until it came to their country, but to start preparing now. And through January, WHO made very clear that firstly, we had to get on with research and development of drugs, vaccines and diagnostics. And that started in the middle of January for vaccines, certainly. And secondly, they made very clear that you had to test. You had to know what was going on in your country and that countries should ramp up testing capacities so that they could make informed decisions about the pandemic. So basically, this is really serious. It's getting more serious. It's going to come to you. Don't wait until it comes, but act now. Put testing and data at the heart of what you do. Remember, traditional public health is so important. And basically, China is buying the world 6 to 8 weeks.
It had never been any secret that testing would be essential to control infectious disease. That, after all, had been one of the recommendations of the BSE inquiry 20 years ago. But unlike some countries, the UK had never taken it seriously enough. As Conservative peer David Willetts, former Minister for Universities and Science in David Cameron's government, explains.
I would say that the big weakness in the UK has been the domestic industrial capacity to do things. And when people here look across at, say, Germany, I don't think that the German kind of scientific advice was necessarily superior to the British scientific advice, but the difference was that Germany had got an industrial base that meant they had the capacity to do a lot of testing from early on. There's no point having advice saying it would be great to do a lot of testing if you don't have inside the UK the ability to do it. The advice is just empty advice.
Without data from tests, the scientists were flying blind, as they repeatedly stressed. They lacked the information they needed to provide truly effective and reliable guidance to policy. In that situation, the right course of action seemed plain. You shut down, buying yourself time to gather more understanding of the challenge and more capability to face the medical crisis. Of course, no one should underestimate the enormity of a decision to lock down the economy. Jeremy Farrer.
I'm a clinical scientist. You know, science in some ways is easy in this. To make a decision at a policy level, you're going to shut down a whole economy. I do appreciate that that's a tough decision. I do think Britain did lock down maybe up to a week too late. And I think that's increasingly supported by the evidence and the data.
Was there ever an alternative to lockdown?
Well, it's a very, very important question. And that's where a lot of the debate has been. And one of the theories is that, you know, perhaps you could sort of take it on the chin, take it all in one go and allow the disease, as it were, to move through the population without really taking as many draconian measures. I think we need to strike a balance.
Boris Johnson's remark on the 5th of March in an interview on ITV left many scientists astounded. It looked by then as though the death rate from COVID-19 could be as high as 5% of those infected. To let the virus sweep unimpeded through the population would then mean around 1 million fatalities. Where had this idea come from? It appeared to have come from the scientists themselves. This is Patrick Vallance on the 13th of March.
And it's important to recognise it's not to stop everybody getting it. You can't do that. It's not possible to stop everybody getting it. And it's also actually not desirable because you want some immunity in the population. We need to have immunity to protect ourselves from this in the future.
Yet it's now plain that this so-called herd immunity played no part in Sage's advice. Jeremy Farrer.
I was not able to join Sage actually through much of February because I was very involved at that stage with work at the WHO and other places. But I was never aware at Sage of the discussion on herd immunity. We didn't know anything about immunity to this virus in March 2020. We actually don't know enough about it or very much about it today. We couldn't be sure that after infection you were immune. And I think, as Patrick Vallance has said more recently, you know, from a group of public health people working in the health sector, clinicians, etc., I don't think anybody could have made a case that herd immunity was a policy choice.
As Richard Horton says, herd immunity might be relevant for a flu epidemic, but not for COVID-19.
I think herd immunity was central to our initial response. All of the epidemiological monitoring for what was an expected pandemic was around influenza, and herd immunity would have been an appropriate way forward. But we got locked in this cognitive bias of thinking that this was an influenza-like epidemic, even though we knew in January that it wasn't. The models didn't change, and therefore the logic that came from those models was to apply herd immunity. It took us way too long, 6 weeks or so, before we finally understood that we were not dealing with influenza. We were dealing with a very severe, highly infectious virus, and we only woke up to that fact when the evidence from Italy started coming through. But the evidence was actually there from China back in January.
The government now denies that herd immunity was ever a part of official policy. By the 16th of March, many European countries were in lockdown, but the UK was not. Neither was it conducting testing in the population. On the contrary, it had abandoned efforts to do so. The scientists had no real idea how widespread the disease was, nor how fast it was spreading. They underestimated both. But there was another reason why the government seemed to be resisting lockdown.
And we need to do this, do the right things at the right time. If people go too early, they become very fatigued. This is going to be a long haul. It is very important we do not start things in advance of need.
Lockdown fatigue was the idea that people might, after several weeks, tire of respecting the rules. Where had this idea come from? Jeremy Farrer again.
On the fatigue issue, I'm not aware that any of the social science and behavioural science colleagues on Sage ever argued for fatigue. And so much depends on populations' willingness to adhere to these public health measures. So much depends on their own experience, whether they trust the advice that's given, whether they see the infection still present in the community and their communities, advice from their friends and colleagues and what they read on the news, and whether they trust that advice. And I don't believe the question of fatigue really ever came in either.
This was one of the most bizarre and also most fatal aspects of how the government was led by the science. Two of the key pieces of scientific advice voiced by the chief scientists at a crucial stage of the pandemic seem to have come from nowhere, and certainly not from other experts. Lockdown happened on the 23rd of March, by which time COVID-19 had already spread widely in the population. Members of the SAGE modelling group have now said that the delay of just a week may have at least doubled the death toll. Something like 30,000 lives might have been saved had it happened sooner. Some scientists began to worry that there was not enough transparency or independence about the scientific research that was feeding into policy. In early May, David King announced that he was creating a separate, unofficial scientific advisory group called Independent SAGE that would pool expert opinion and, as King told me, to put science in the public domain. It was an unprecedented challenge to the system of science advice that King himself had participated in years before. Now it was out in the open. Being led by the science couldn't mean very much when there was no single definitive body of scientific opinion to be led by. But by this point, it had become hard to know where the science stopped and the politics began, as Richard Horton says.
The relationship between the scientific and medical advisers and politicians as we were managing the early phase of the epidemic was strangely collusive. The scientists were acting together with politicians to support the political response to the outbreak. We had medical advisers saying that the UK was an international exemplar in preparedness, when that was clearly not true. That saw the death of independent medical and scientific advice, and that was a terrifying failure.
If indeed independent scientific and medical advice died, some felt that happened live on TV.
I understand that some will say that I should have spoken to the Prime Minister before deciding what to do. So I drove the three of us up to Durham that night, arriving roughly at midnight. I did not stop on the way.
On the 22nd of May, we learned that Dominic Cummings had arguably breached the lockdown rules after driving to Durham with his family, suspecting they had caught the virus. When the chief scientific advisor and chief medical officer were quizzed for their views on the matter at the end of May, we saw what the relationship of science advice to governance had now become. The first question on this from the press was intercepted by Boris Johnson.
You've asked Chris and Patrick, but I'm going to interpose myself, if I may, and protect them from what I think would be an unfair and unnecessary attempt to ask a political question. It's very, very important that our medical officers and scientific advisers do not get dragged into what I think most people will recognise is fundamentally a political argument.
But when the press persisted and it became impossible for Valance and Whitty to evade the issue, this is what they said.
I can assure you that the desire not to get pulled into politics is far stronger on the part of Sir Patrick and me than it is in the Prime Minister.
That's for sure. Yeah. Thanks. Yes. Sorry.
I've got nothing to add. I mean, I'm a civil servant. I'm politically neutral. I don't want to get involved in politics at all.
But the notion that the Cummings affair was fundamentally a political argument, as Johnson claimed, is disproved by the science. When it became clear that Cummings would suffer no consequences for his breach of the rules, public trust in the government plummeted, as Julia Pierce explains.
Evidence is starting to come out to suggest that trust has been reduced over the course of the COVID-19 crisis. A recent report from the think tank British Future indicates that public trust in the government handling of the crisis fell after Dominic Cummings was seen to break the rules. This is certainly consistent with the literature on trust, which demonstrates the importance of perceived fairness and also shared values.
This damage to trust seems likely to have ongoing implications for public health. Stephen Reicher is a behavioural scientist at the University of St Andrews who sat on the SPY-B subcommittee that advised Sage about this aspect of the science.
The cost comes later because, for instance, there is evidence which shows that when you look at the test and trace system and people's willingness to give information, to give their contacts to the system, that is less likely if you don't trust the government. So if you are asked to do something which directly relies on trust in government, what will they do with my information? It is undermined by that loss of trust. So I think the evidence is showing us that the Cummings affair undermined trust. In the immediate, it probably wasn't too harmful. In the longer term, though, it undermines the ability of people to do things which require trust in the government, and it undermines the influence of the government overall. And that's not a good look in the midst of a crisis.
It was from this point that the message changed and the facade of unity began to crack. Julia Pierce notes how this discord grew.
Initially, public trust in that stay home, protect the NHS, save lives message was high across the political spectrum. There was this idea that the guidance was led by the science. However, what happened when there was this shift to the newer message, let's move around, stay alert, control the virus, save lives, around this point you started to see less consensus. So you saw that the governments of Scotland, Wales and Northern Ireland weren't following the same message. The scientific community were actually being quite vocal about the concerns that this wasn't a clear, actionable message. So you start to see a breakdown in that consistency that you might hope for, and also in that sense that the message was being driven by the science.
At least one member of Sage declined to be interviewed for this programme for fear that it would become an attempt to attribute blame. Several others did not respond to our requests. None of this bodes well for the future. We are not out of the pandemic yet. In fact, globally, it's worse now than ever. And many experts fear that there's more to come for Europe, perhaps in the winter when social distancing would be harder to sustain. Decision-making can't do without science, and it will depend on public trust. But those relationships have suffered a lot of attrition. We need to ask where mistakes were made, but must accept too that no one could have been expected to respond flawlessly to such a challenging crisis. We should be ready to assume that when the scientists made errors of judgment, they did so in good faith. What matters more in the long run is what we can learn from it, both in terms of preparedness for pandemics, but also in terms of what we can reasonably expect from science as it informs policy. Arguably, the British government relinquished too much to science. Instead of making hard but necessary decisions quickly, it abrogated responsibility to scientists. But as David Willett says, science cannot and should not lead policymaking.
When you're at the cutting edge of a rapidly changing situation like this one, the scientists themselves are often busy arguing with each other. So there isn't a kind of right scientific view that ministers then automatically act on. Ministers' decisions will be based on more than simply a scientific assessment of the virus. There's a whole host of things which ultimately, quite rightly, are for ministerial decision. And the implicit contract is the scientists get to have their voice heard, and in return, they accept the ministers will ultimately decide on what should be done. And I think, and anyway, I'm a traditionist on this, I think it was Churchill who said scientists should be on tap but not on top, and that's the right model in a democracy.
But in this case, being led by the science meant that science could initially act as a shield against taking hard choices, and now perhaps as a scapegoat for the errors. At the same time, that slogan presented a dangerously simplistic view of what science is and how it works. It is not a reservoir of objective truth that can be accessed by turning on a tap.
You need to earn the trust of the public. You have these one-liners, like following the science, but really what needed to be deconstructed there was what science were you following, what were the probabilities that was right, are you considering other options? A much more complicated set of messages. Now, communications professionals don't like that. They like one-liners. But science doesn't actually work like that. So you have to have communication which is more sophisticated, which earns trust, and which allows the science to be respected, and the lack of understanding in the science, the tentative knowledge, to be acknowledged, which I'm afraid it wasn't.
Faced with huge uncertainties and lack of data, the scientists themselves were perhaps not sufficiently willing to admit that they simply didn't know enough to plot a reliable route around hard political choices. Neither did they seem to demand the trust and freedom to communicate independently and frankly the provisional and tentative nature of their business. The importance of making that plain was stressed by Sir Robert May, chief scientific advisor in the inquiry into the BSE epidemic, when he argued that the full messy process whereby scientific understanding is arrived at has to be spilled out into the open. This gets to the nub of the problem with being allegedly led by the science. The ideals of science, transparency, respect for facts, internationalism, admission of uncertainty and contingency, readiness to revise opinion and admit errors, clash with the way politics is conducted today. Successful use of science in policy will not gloss over this fact, but will find an effective reconciliation with it. At the same time, science must not itself collude in the fiction that it is a machine for the flawless production of objective truths and certainties. It is not a panacea, not monolithic, not omniscient or omnipotent, not immune to human error and bias, to conflicts of interest and values. It cannot, of itself, be our saviour, and neither can it be our leader.